It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, you can't sit down at a table and enjoy food without thinking about the coffee. At least I can't. The coffee that's going to fall over and be with it. And it's the way that many of us start every single day. Well, I'm starting this day really enjoying the aromas and a little noise you hear in the background of coffee roasting. And I'm sitting here visiting with the owners of a coffee roasting company. They have a coffee shop, and they have a special relationship with their farmers. They know the farmers. They know the beans. It's an interesting story. And I think if there's one thing that we're about with Farm to Table Talk, it's interesting stories that are connecting us as consumers with the farmers, and you need to have people in the middle that care. Andy and Edie, welcome to Farm to Table Talk, and you care about this sort of thing.
We do. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
You know, one thing that listening to this podcast, people aren't going to be able to necessarily be enjoying the coffee I'm enjoying right now. You gave me a cup of coffee. Tell me, what is the coffee I'm having? I really like it.
Well, it's from Guatemala. The farm is Finca La Merced, and it's a producer we've known for eight years at least. We visit every other year to the farm, and he comes to visit us every year also.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, how did that get started? I mean, there's a lot of people that, not a lot of people, drink coffee, and a lot of people have sold coffee in the past. I mean, some remember when I was growing up, you know, got a cup of coffee for a dime someplace, and no one knew much about it, except it was like Maxwell House or Folgers or something, and instant oftentimes. So how do you two find yourself in the coffee business?
That's always a hard one.
Oh, no, come on. You can do it.
We loved coffee, and we wanted to do a business, and we wanted to do something we could do for the rest of our lives. And coffee is always changing. We're all learning more every year, so we're never bored. Every year the coffees taste a little different, like any crop does, so it's never boring. We look forward to new crops coming in and looking for new coffees.
Yeah, and farmers these days too, it's a younger generation, so they're starting to experiment more with different processing, so we're getting different types and styles of coffee from the same farm. So that keeps it interesting.
So, Andy, I can tell on the audio that I mentioned earlier to you, too. I could get a little bit of an accent, you mentioned you're from New Zealand.
I am, yeah. So Edie and I met in New Zealand, and we were going to do coffee down there at some stage, weren't we?
We were, yeah.
And then we decided to move back to the States for family reasons. And then when I got here, it was early 2000s, and coffee was very... No offense, it was really disappointing. Everything was really dark roasted, and there was no flavors. I left a lot of coffees on tables. And coming from a New Zealand coffee culture where it's a lot milder, a lot sweeter, it's more espresso-based culture, it was a bit of a cultural shock moving here.
So that's interesting, because really, when you say that, that was like around the 2000. At that time, when the coffee shops were kind of getting established, everything was really heavy, dark, French roast to put a lot of milk in for lattes and so forth. Did I get that right? I mean, it's kind
no,
of seen
that. That's what.
So it's almost like burnt coffee, but it held up pretty well if you're putting a lot of milk in it.
In a way.
Yeah. I mean, the duck. I mean, that's why people put a lot of milk in it too.
Because of the bitter flavors that you get. So growing up here in the States, yeah, that's all we had. I never had anything but a dark roast, and I moved to New Zealand, and oh my gosh, this coffee was sweet. It was completely different. It opened my eyes to a whole new world of coffee. Didn't know it had great sweetness in it.
And so you decide that maybe we could get a business started.
Yeah.
You came up here and you open a coffee shop first?
We did. Yeah, it took us a few years to write a business plan and find the right location. But we opened our first coffee shop in 2008.
Yeah.
So that just hit its 10-year anniversary. And then 2 years in, we started to do our own roasting. So we took a little more control about our own product and started roasting 2010. And then we opened this roastery cafe 2015. 13, and now we're opening a new store in town, hopefully in another 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So you've, and when you did this, I mean, you started roasting. So first you were in coffee, so you were just buying beans from somebody else that were already roasted then.
Right.
And you were doing some grinding then for the people, I suppose, just to, you got beans and then they could grind them themselves, or you grind them then.
Right. So first off, we did research for years. That's why it took about 4 years of research before we opened a cafe. And in that time, we went around the Bay Area and we went everywhere and looked for roasters and started our learning process. And we felt we found a really good high quality roaster that had amazing coffee. And after a couple of years, as Andy said, we felt that we wanted to take a little bit more control of that. So we ended up going on a Roasters Guild trip to Guatemala with like 27 other roasters. We weren't roasters yet, but it was perfect. 10 days of visiting farms, learning about the growing process and meeting producers and talking to other roasters. And they all helped us a lot.
There's a Roasters Guild.
There is.
There's a specialty coffee association, and in that there's a Roasters Guild, a Barista Guild. They just started a Tech Guild, and they also have a Producers Guild.
That's in the works, yeah.
Now, are they based in the States, or guilds often were in Europe? You didn't used to hear much of guilds in the United States.
Well, up until a year ago, it was the Specialty Coffee Association of America, and they just joined with Europe, so now we have one. But I think they have separate guilds still in Europe, and we have ours here in the U.S.
I spoke to a guild in London one time, and I ended up being kind of embarrassed because they had such tough questions about the origin of our foods and the varieties and the farming practices, and I just like smacked my head because I thought I didn't know anybody cared that much of the amount of detail they go into, far exceeding like regulations or how do you define this and so forth. But they really got into it.
Yeah.
So now, is this guild? Is it a non-profit, and you have to pay to join and that sort of thing?
Yes.
Sure.
So we always encourage people, like we have wholesale customers come to us, and even people that are interested in coffee, go join the Specialty Coffee Association. You can take classes. They have once a year. They have a big expo that we all go to. There's competitions. We've had baristas compete in those. And now they just keep adding on more and more. They have roasters competitions. It's a great place to find like-minded people when you're really passionate about something.
So you get into that circle and you're with like-minded people and you're getting educated. How do you start making these farm connections, the farmers, and getting acquainted with who is growing what type of coffee and how?
Right. Well, the first was that trip to Guatemala. We met a lot of producers. And the one you're drinking, we had already been buying their coffee from the roaster that we bought coffee from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So here we are all these years later, and we have a direct relationship with him now. We sat down and made a price for about 3 years, and we started to cut out some of the middle people because he wanted to add more processing plant to his farm and add, what did he do?
Well, he added a lot. So first he wanted to do his own wet milling, so that's processing the ripe cherry. In the past, he'd send it off to another mill, so he wanted to take control of that. So by us setting a price for a three-year period, he had a fixed income coming from us that he could then reinvest into the farm and make those upgrades. Since that, he's expanded the mill. He's added solar dryers on his patio, so it's like a big enclosed structure with multiple levels of drying racks, so he can now dry more coffee on the same square footage as what he was doing before. He's added a closed circuit water system, so when he processes his coffee, all the water is recycled through the washing and the processing, and then that water gets treated now, and then it gets used for the nursery, so it's nothing gets dumped back in the environment, it's all reused.
That's incredible.
Yep,
that's
incredible. Expanded the nursery too.
That's incredible. Yep. So when you visited him the first time, what surprised you? I mean, you knew about the coffee. You'd already been getting the beans when you got and you go out to the farm. I mean, when you go to the farm, what seemed different? I mean, again, your experience was drinking coffee and seeing what the beans looked like when they came there. But right. Anything surprise you?
I think the biggest surprise was that there's people, these producers down there at the farms, have equal or more passion than us for the product. So, I mean, they're putting in the real hard effort to grow the coffee and get it processed to give us the best product possible. And that was kind of surprising that, you know, they cared as much as we did, probably
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
Because their hands on the ground, they're the start of the whole process.
Right.
I mean, we can only ruin it from our point of view, but we try not to.
You know, it's funny. I've done a podcast with somebody that was sourcing the, you know, cocoa beans, and if you will, mm-hmm. and mainly in Africa, but in some other areas as well. And those farmers often didn't ever get to try the finished product, so they were involved sometimes in farming those beans, and they really had to be brought chocolates back from the States or Europe mm-hmm. to yeah. taste what the outcome was. Now, in your case, your experience with these, like they're farmers, they drink the coffee and they know good coffee when they make it. They don't.
They're exactly the same. They yep. haven't tried good coffee because they don't have, you know, a big roasting plant like we do that can.
Which is a little right. noise in the background. Yeah. People are wondering, you know, what am I hearing? There's a little roasting going on out here.
There is, and so with the coffee that they grow, all the good stuff that we get, it's exported. So all the stuff that's not good stays domestically.
Right.
So they don't drink good coffee. The only time they'll get it is if we send it back.
Right. And a lot of them didn't really know
how to brew
properly.
Really?
Like, we're really into ratios and weighing and your temperature of water is this and you only brew for so long.
I remember going to one farm in Guatemala and this producer was struggling and he made us all a coffee, but he boiled the coffee for 15 minutes in a pot and then strained it through a tea towel.
And it was sad because none of us were all looking at each other like, oh, I don't want to be rude, but it wasn't good.
It could have been a great coffee, but yeah. it wasn't prepared well. So.
Right. So sometimes that's the nice thing. We can give them a little information to help them, but most of the time they're just giving us lots of information.
So the state of the farms there, is it like farms here, you go up and they live in a farmstead or something, a house by, what is it, an orchard and have a pickup truck and a dog and you know.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And they're different, you know, different countries yeah. are different. Honduras, where we go, we buy from a co-op.
Two farmers in a co-op.
Two yeah. different farmers. We get the best of their lots, so we get micro lots from two of them. And they're just like a block away, and you walk everywhere. And those farms are really close together.
Right. They're small scale. They live on the farm permanently. Some farms, you know, they'll live in town, and then they'll commute back and forth to the farms because they have managers who run the farm. It depends on where it is in the scale of the farm.
So I don't even know what a coffee farm might look like in terms of, is it like flat ground or it could be hilly ground, mountainous?
It can be all of the above. So, you know, like in Guatemala, Honduras, you're in very mountainous, Costa Rica, kind of mountainous region. So it is steep. Everything's hand-picked because you can't get machinery up the sides of mountains. And then in places like Brazil, it would be like, you've been there, you'd be like going to Napa Valley. It's all perfect rows of coffee
right.
plantations.
And it's machine-picked.
Machine-picked, just like.
Completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about the soil? Is the soil, I mean, you go some places and the soil's red and some that it's light tan and some that's, you
well,
know, some reach black.
You think Guatemala has lots of volcanoes, so you mm-hmm. have some.
Lots of mineral content. You go further north in Guatemala and you've got the rainforest region. It's like a heavy clay, so that's going to change the acidity versus, say, Acatenango, where it's literally surrounded by mountains and, you know, igneous rocks.
And that's just one country, and it has so many different flavor profiles coming out of that because of all of those influences.
Well, I wondered about that. I mean, can you taste the soil in the coffee? You
no.
can't. I mean, well, I obviously didn't. You know what I meant.
No, I know.
Yeah.
It will affect maybe levels of acidity or the balance of sweetness and fruit acidity and body and change those aspects. So, but you can't pinpoint it to just the soil.
No,
there's
no.
Rainfall, sunshine, processing, roasting, brewing. There's all those things can affect it.
Elevation, varietal.
Now, in some other produce, certainly, I think fruits and vegetables, you can affect the flavor by limiting water sometimes. I mean, and in some really good wines, the more that a plant has to struggle, it gets more flavor into the fruit itself. Is that true with coffee?
It could be. I'm not sure for exactly if it's true, but you'd get likely limited production, and for a coffee producer, that's not good.
No, there's intensity in the fruit, and that's the reason that those wines cost $60 a bottle instead of the $9 ones. Mm-hmm. You know,
coffee should cost the same.
Yep.
Is it really?
It should.
Yeah.
The amount of hands it goes through, and the processing, and the travel. I mean, you know, we're surrounded by wineries within 100 miles. Our coffee comes thousands of miles away, so it's got to go on ships, it's got to go on trucks, it's got to get to here. Yep. There's a lot of hands that it passes through.
So if you two were going to be able to go flying around the world and go see a farm and see how they were farming those coffee beans, could you predict what the coffee was going to taste like just by kind of looking at the farm?
No.
You can't. You can't tell.
No. It'd be like going to a winery and predicting what the wine would taste like.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't think you could.
So how important is... I mean, so what you start with, one is genetics. So there's a variety, I suppose, of coffee beans.
There's thousands of varieties. So when we go to a farm, we look at how they maintain the farm. We look at the quality of the fruit. We look at how they pick the coffee. Are they picking just ripe cherry, or are they just stripping the tree completely of all of it, unripes and ripes? You know, and then every farm has different, like in Brazil, we have a farmer down there. We buy a particular varietal. We buy his whole lot of a varietal called Yellow Bourbon. Well, he's got hills where one side of the hill gets more sunshine than the other, and you've got the same varietal on each side, but they taste vastly different because we're getting more sunlight hours on one, less on the other. It might be more susceptible to rain and wind on one side, less on the other. So those factors will change it too.
Right.
So even though it's the same plant, same processing, that would be a different lot of coffee because they would have different characteristics.
Right. But if you look at... when Andy found our Costa Rican producers, Sarah and Alexander Delgado, he was with an importer, and they went to lots of farms, right? So you go and visit a lot of farms at once, and you can take pictures and ask questions, and you kind of get a sense of what the people are like. Are they passionate? You know, like he said, he looked at all those factors, and then they go and cup. And you cup blindly, and you take all your notes, and you go, okay, I like this one the best, this one, and this one. So for Andy, on that one trip, he loved Sarah and Alexander and their little girl and their doggie, and he loved the farm and everything. And it turned out in the blind tasting, it was one of his top two. So that was a no-brainer. We're buying that we loved everything about him, and it followed through to the cup. And that's what's really important in the end. That's what our customers see, is the taste in the cup.
Well, and the love. I mean, the fact that you can get a story like that, that you can go all the way back to not only where the beans came from in the country and the farm, and that it's a nice family and their farming practices, and they got a little girl. And
when I went to see them, they had a second little girl.
I don't know. Did anybody send you Christmas cards or anything?
No, everybody's on Facebook these days.
So
we can ask them questions anytime, and we'll get answers. And it's made it quite nice.
So you've got these kind of connections. How many farmers do you know fairly well that are supplying you now?
We've got Omar, Pedro, Jose Isidro, Jose Maria, Juan Luis, Omar Arango in Colombia.
That's right.
And Sarah and Alexander in Costa Rica.
So just seven, and we're going to start
with Rina.
Rina in Nicaragua soon. Next.
So I would guess in the coffee business, there's also people that are commodity producers.
Right.
Now, you know, they must be typical to commodity production. Larger scale and large processing companies must be contracting with them.
Right.
So it's a whole different kind of enterprise.
It is. So when you talked earlier about how we all grew up on the dark roast, there's two different types of coffee. There's the Robusta, which is low growing, and it doesn't have the amazing flavor profiles as an Arabica, which is higher growing. So when you talk about specialty
lower
coffee,
and higher, you're saying?
Yeah, elevation.
Oh, okay.
So our coffees are Arabica coffees. They're growing at higher elevations.
4,000 or 5,000 feet or 3,000
feet? 3,000 up.
3,000 up, okay.
And they have longer times on their vines.
Yeah,
or
they
trees.
Take longer to mature, to ripen.
So they have longer to develop all these sugars and all these amazing flavors. Where what you and I grew up on was that Robusta,
right.
Lower growing, not a lot of flavor, basically a bitter flavor, and we didn't have choices like we do now. So our whole business is specialty coffee, and that's Arabica.
Oh, okay.
So there's two different, and when you talk commodity, that is generally the Robusta and not as many
flavors. Or lower grade Arabica.
Lower grade Arabicas, yeah.
You know, this is reminding me, I had an opportunity to go to a UN meeting in about environmental issues in Nairobi, Kenya. Some coffee farmers wanted to get together and talk. They were frustrated because they felt like they were so much at the mercy of whatever the three or four big coffee companies were. And it sounded like they wished they could get to that stage, but it just seemed like they were having a really, really difficult time. Now, I would imagine elevation is somewhat of an issue with Kenya then, too. I don't hear these stories as much about Africa as what you're talking about in Latin America. Is that true? Is it my perception?
African coffees are amazing. They just, we haven't personally been there yet because we're a small company and we'd love to go. We do buy African coffees. Kenya, you talked about the soil. Affecting flavor.
It's kind of red soil.
And that one was a really big change for Kenyan coffees.
Yeah, so with Kenyan coffees, you know, you seem to get more of, well, in the past you used to get more of a blackcurrant note from it, but lately you get more of the vegetal, tomato-y kind of notes coming through, so they have a very unique taste. And they're putting it down to, like you say, the red soil. There's a lot of phosphoric acid in the soil, and that does affect the end result, and that's kind of unique to Kenyan coffees as well.
Right.
Of certain varietals, there's SL28 and SL34 and Ruru 11, but those are the kind of main specialty coffee varietals out there.
You know, I love coffee before this conversation, but you two are making me love it even more. And you know, it's one thing I hope is kind of accomplished with conversations like this is that people have some gratitude for the way that the products are grown and people that are caring for them along the way. I mean, you're in a stage between that farmer and what people are having for their breakfast coffee. And I think it's great. I mean, we should hope you're successful at this sort of thing. And it's exciting, too, to see how much you truly love the venture that you're in right now. I wonder, though, I mean, it's kind of like craft beers now, too. I mean, there's a lot of small beer companies doing some really interesting craft beers. But the specialty coffee companies, how do you feel about that, about the prospects for the business long term? Because you guys are doing a spectacular job here out of Sacramento, California, with Chocolate Fish. And I suspect there are some other companies like yours around the world. How do you feel about the future? What makes you kind of optimistic about the business that you're in?
Well, I think the specialty coffee is a growing market. And, you know, in the coming years, we will face problems with shortage of coffees, of good coffees, because it's a very minute, you know, it's literally 3% of the entire coffee market.
Mm-hmm.
But it is growing. So now, as you get more, it's just like craft beer, there's going to be supply problems with hops, but we get the same with coffee. So by developing relationships with certain farmers, we can also buy futures and contract prices. So like way back in November, December, I'd already booked my coffees from my producers to make sure I get coffee for the season. So they don't start picking till January through April, but I've already purchased before they've even started picking. So by us developing relationships, it gives us a little bit more of a comfort that we will still get coffees
right.
in the future.
And I think it's also hopeful because a lot of the farmers now are younger. They have grown up, they went away to college, and they came back, and they're taking over farms, and they're looking at experimenting different ways. They're enthusiastic about it because we don't want to lose those farmers. You know, sometimes other crops will give them more money, but we need to spread the word about specialty coffee and get people to understand how unique it is and why they should be paying higher prices for it so that we don't lose those farmers. We all have to keep them sustainable.
So those farmers, are their kids going off to college and majoring in coffee? Are they?
No, and that is another issue too. It's like you've got the younger generation coming through and now they want to go and live in the cities and they don't want to farm because they want to become doctors and IT professionals and marketing and that. So they're looking at other career avenues, I guess. And so that is always an issue too, that you don't have that next generation coming through taking over the farm as well.
Well, just give them. Give them a little time, and they'll come back the other way, just like we've experienced here. We've got a lot of listeners, I know, to Farm to Table Talk that are in other careers, and they've gone off and gotten a degree in, you know, Silicon Valley and so forth, and they listen to Farm to Table Talk because they'd like to be raising coffee in Guatemala if they could. And so there is a passion that has to be profitable, but there is a passion through the whole thing.
Yeah.
We just want to wrap up a couple quick things. So if your connection to coffee is, to a lot of people that might be listening, it's drinking it. I mean, what advice do you have to somebody that drinks coffee to build on their own appreciation of specialty coffees?
Oh, there's so much knowledge. You can get on the internet, start talking to people, taking classes at your local coffee houses to learn more.
Ask them where it comes from.
Yep.
Ask them more about the coffee. Find out where it comes from.
Purchase from people that know their producers, that know what their coffee is, that are selling high quality. If our consumers don't become more educated, it's not going to help the specialty coffee world. They need to expect more out of every coffee roaster and every cafe and every barista for us to elevate specialty coffee and help our farmers.
That's great advice, and I think it's one that I'd like to leave with everybody on a lot of different foods too, is that, you know, pause before you just gobble or swallow up whatever it is you're eating, and think about where it came from and how it was grown, and the care that went into it to bringing it to your table. And you guys have put together materials. You've got about your coffee roasting and your relationships and the farmers and so forth. Can people find that online if they'd like to see it?
Yeah.
We have all this on chocolatefishcoffee.com.
Chocolatefishcoffee.com. And I got to ask you this because somebody's going to be wondering. Chocolatefish is a strange name for practically anything, as a matter of fact. But how do you, quickly, how do you come to be called Chocolatefish?
So, as you mentioned earlier, that I had an accent and I'm from New Zealand, so when we opened our first shop, we wanted a name that was reflective of home. So in New Zealand, a chocolate fish is an iconic candy that we give to people as a thank you.
Ah.
And it's made by, well, Cadbury's make them, other people make them, but it's unique to New Zealand. So if someone did you a favor, you'd hand them a chocolate fish. And
I'm glad I asked. Well, I tell you what, Andy Baker and Edie Baker, Chocolate Fish, I really appreciate. Thanks for the coffee, and
you're
thanks
welcome.
For the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.